Ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the UI Breakfast Podcast. I'm your host, Jane Portman, and today our special guest is Val Geisler, an email onboarding copywriter and strategist, and we're going to talk about best practices in SaaS email onboarding. This episode is brought to you by userlist.io, a new tool for sending event-based email to your SaaS users. Overwhelmed with existing automation tools? Try this simple solution for converting free trials, user onboarding, and promoting specific features in your web application. To learn more, join the waiting list at userlist.io. Hey, Val!
Hi, Jane. Thanks for having me on the show.
Thank you for finding time. We're thrilled to have your wisdom at our disposal today.
It's my pleasure to be here.
How about we start with a Blitz questionnaire so that we can learn more about you and then continue with the main topic?
For sure.
And question number one is, what do you do for a living?
I write a lot of emails. So I work with B2C SaaS companies and help them both write and strategize around their email onboarding sequences, which also leads to retention emails and cancellation emails. I help reduce customer churn through email marketing for B2C SaaS. That's the best thing I do. I save customers every day.
That's a wonderful place to be at. And as we say, you're very, very close to the money of SaaS businesses, right?
Yeah. And that's something that I think a lot of people miss about onboarding is that it truly should be part of your revenue plan, right? So you're saving customers you've already attracted as opposed to trying to attract new ones.
Absolutely. I just watched a recap of Patrick Campbell's talk at FemtoConf, which Benedict kindly sent to me. And he says that these days, customer acquisition is really not a fantastic strategy. Retention is way more important.
Yeah, I could not agree more. I mean, I don't know why companies spend so much time and effort, with sales teams and on acquisition and cold advertisement strategies and all of those different ways to bring in new customers when you can have a really powerful business with a couple thousand super happy customers, right? So keep them happy and keep them ongoing customers and you can have a super solid business at your hands as opposed to constantly trying to attract new customers because you're worried about the customers that are turning out, why not just reduce your churn numbers?
Absolutely. How did you get there? What's your background story?
So I came to what I do now today through being the number one marketer at ConvertKit, an email marketing software. So,
I didn't know that. That's great.
So I used to run my own business, so I know a lot about running business as a business owner. I was a project manager for online business owners, and at the time I was a ConvertKit customer, and I joined the team as their first marketing hire, really focused on writing content, but. You know, I found like, I don't want to just write content. I want to be in charge of the distribution of this content. And I want to help our customers that we're attracting stay customers and better interact with our content and things like that. So so I took over all of the email communication for ConvertKit as well as the content creation and got to know more than I ever thought I would want to know about email marketing, working as the in-house email marketer for an email marketing company. I know a little bit about everything about email, and now I bring all of that to. I'm able to do just the things that I really love doing, which is that customer journey and making sure that the customer experience through email marketing is really, really powerful for B2C brands.
Fantastic. I wonder, at ConvertKit, were you helping to create actual email content that your customers would send to their users, or were you focused on primarily, retaining and nurturing ConvertKit's customers?
That's a great question. It's something that we were building out kind of as I was transitioning out of the team, was like a library of content that, if you're a food blogger, here's a whole onboarding sequence that you could use, or the different types of ConvertKit is built for bloggers and online content creators. So we were kind of building like toolkits for those different customer avatars. And I don't know where that project is today. Obviously, I haven't been there in a long time, but when I was leaving, that was something that was kind of in the works, was a project of you could go in and grab pre-written content based on your different like demographic or niche. And I was also in charge of the emails and things that went out to existing customers. I mostly focused on the content distribution as far as the blog and then some of the account retention, like long-term account retention. And then my friend Matt Ragland runs all the onboarding at ConvertKit. So he was really heading up onboarding, and then we kind of partnered up on the overlap between onboarding a new customer and then retaining a long-term customer.
Great. What does your typical day look like?
It really varies, which is super fun. I tend to work, I do day rates a lot of times. So I will, with a repeating customer, that if they need me to come back and work on a campaign for them after we've done a project together, I typically have like a day booked out for a client every week. So that's just like a focused sit down, get my writing done, work on the project kind of day, where I get to focus on one customer beginning to end throughout the day. And that I love. I love that super focused time where I get to just think about one brand and one ideal customer and write and create strategies and segments for them. Otherwise, the rest of the week, I am working on those projects where I work with teams on longer term projects where we are covering everything from data mining and research. So I do customer interviews for the brands. So a lot of times I spend a good portion of my day on the phone with my customer's customer, doing some deeper dive research into who they are and why they chose this particular platform and what they are wanting to get out of it. I love doing that customer research and then compiling that data and having that inform the strategy and the writing that I do. So I'd say that I spend, 20% of my week on the phone with, customer inquiries kind of thing as far as like customer interviews go. And then probably, 40 or 50% of the time is strategy, and the remainder of the time is actually doing the writing work.
Wonderful. That's a very, very precise breakdown.
Yeah, I want it to be, what's important to me is that writing is not what's taking up the majority of my time. I'm a pretty speedy writer. Once I have the strategy and the research done. So strategy takes up a good portion of the time. And I think that it's important that people understand having a good strategy in place. Yeah, it takes time. But once it's set, then you can repeat it easily, right? So if you understand your customers really well, if you understand the strategy behind it, writing the emails that go to that is quite simple. At least it's simple for me as a conversion-focused copywriter. It might not be simple for other people, but that's it. I think it's important to know that the research into your customers and then the strategy built around that research is almost more important than the writing itself.
That is probably so for any industry, not just writing, design as well.
Yeah, I can't tell you how many people I talk to who I say, the first thing I start with is interviewing your customers, and or if, unless you have that data already. And so many people say, I don't have that data. I've never gotten on the phone with a customer other than to like troubleshoot, you know, where they'll have a customer call for support purposes, but they never talk to their customers to find out why the customer even chose their platform in the first place. So we start there.
Right. What do you enjoy the most and the least about your work?
So I am pretty clear that I am an introvert. It's a big part of who I am. And so one of the things that that I do try to balance is the amount of time I am talking to other people. I'd say one of the things that I like the least is the days and weeks where I'm on back-to-back calls and don't really have that space to sit down and focus on strategy and writing. Those are more like introverted tasks, I think. As much as, you know, the data and research is super important, and so I prioritize it, but it can be draining to, if the schedule for the project means I need to be on back-to-back calls for a couple of days. So that would probably be what I like the least, which isn't bad, right? Like, it's not bad to, like, to have the least favorite thing about your job be that you have to talk to people. And the thing I like the most is it actually is kind of in line with what I like the least. The thing I like the most is that I get to talk to lots of different people. You know, yeah, it is. It's weird that it's the same, but it is, because I love figuring out why people do what they do. And that means talking to them most of the time. And I love when what I find out aligns with my customers' suspicions anyways. And I found that that happens a lot, that I bring back the research that I've done, and they say, oh, good, that's exactly what we were thinking. I'm like, oh, cool, great. You've just proven your thoughts. Instead of them just being thoughts, they're now scientific facts based on the interviews and research that have been done.
If only it was like scientific facts, but these are definitely confirmed assumptions, right?
Yeah, confirmed assumptions for sure. You know, when you can, if someone's building a product based on an assumption, that can be really challenging to know who your customers are and who to how to market to them. Absolutely. Unless you're maybe building the product for yourself, which I know you have experience doing.
In one of our previous episodes with Patrick McKenzie, he said that you should not build a SaaS before talking to at least 50 people. 50 people. And I think that's a giant number.
But it's really not. You know, I've heard, and even on, not just in SaaS, but in every industry, you shouldn't move forward with an idea for your product, your marketplace, your community, whatever you're building, until you've talked to, I think 50 people is a minimum as far as the number of people to talk to. So to give you an idea, when I work with my customers, I always ask that I get a list of 20 names of customers of theirs to interview, so that by the end of it, I'm maybe scheduling 8 to 10 interviews because people have scheduling conflicts or don't want to or whatever. But yeah, I want to do at least 10, and that's after the product already exists. 50, I love that challenge, and I think everyone should do it and then tell Patrick what you learned from it.
When we were planning userlist.io, we interviewed like 20 people, and we are so proud of ourselves. And then Patrick calls out a number of 50, and we're like, oh man.
I saw the research that you guys were doing, and you know, that's so incredibly important. And it informs, not only, like you said, it confirms your assumptions, but it also it gives you new ideas. It gives you something to go off of for, oh yeah, let's actually plan that feature in, or let's completely scrap this other feature because no one has talked about wanting it.
Absolutely. And for those who are listening, I'm going to link to the episode with Claire where we go in depth. We have a very in-depth conversation about those interviews and the findings of that.
Yeah.
Val, what is your next big thing, personally, professionally?
Yeah. My next big thing is going to conferences and getting out into the world. So it's both personal and professional because my business, I was, like I said, I was in-house at ConvertKit up until July of last year, of 2017. So being in-house there, I didn't have to do a lot of like networking with other people. It kind of came naturally. Like people came to us as another startup company. And I want to get to know people more. I want to meet other founders. I want to meet other product people. I want to meet other writers and strategists and email people. So I'm going to both industry conferences like Litmus for email industry, and then I'm also going to conferences like Business of Software for the industry that I work in. So getting out and talking to people in real life is my goal for 2018, doing more of it, whether I'm going as an attendee or I'm going as a speaker or a panelist.
That's a fantastic goal. And I should say that in the SaaS founder industry, for some reason, the your topic is really underrepresented somehow.
I couldn't agree more.
it seems so obvious, such an obvious thing to do and to think about, but there is not enough material, and there is obviously, I don't know about many prominent speakers on the topic. So are you in a wonderful niche?
Well, great. That's great to hear. I have found the same thing. People talk about churn. They talk about, attracting new customers. They talk about marketing. But talking about how you do all of that through email marketing is really missing. And email isn't going anywhere. It still performs better than social. It still performs better than almost every channel out there. People still sign up for email lists. Open your emails. They still sign up for free trials. So we need to be communicating with people by email. And there's the, there's good ways to do it, and there's ways that can get you marked as spam and canceled accounts really quickly. So I want to spread the word about what those ways are.
That's a fantastic, fantastic strategy, and I'm hoping we're gonna get some of your insight on that right now when we continue to the main topic. So when let's start with the definition. So life cycle emails are so often overlooked, and they are sometimes classified as email marketing, while exactly they're not so much marketing but nurturing and onboarding, retaining, and other words like that. So your definition, what lifecycle emails are, onboarding emails are?
Yeah, so I always say that onboarding emails are simply the like gateway drug to lifecycle emails in general, right? So onboarding is something that people can really easily understand. Okay, cool, I need to onboard my new customers, my new trial accounts. Once you do that, once you get them onboarded and they are converted, so the job of a trial email is to that whole campaign, the whole job of it is to convert your customers. And there's many different ways you can go about that. But once they actually convert, then you're in a retention period. So there's the next phase of the life cycle is they're converted, they're a paying customer, and you want to retain them. You want to see that customer lifetime value going up and up and up. And so you're in that retention period with existing accounts. And then there's a third phase of the life cycle, and that's when they've canceled. So you have a whole series of cancellation emails. So not just like confirming the fact that they canceled and yes, we closed your account and here's where you can go get all of your customer data, or, whatever you needed before your account is completely closed or deleted. All those details are important. But there's also a campaign that comes after that for canceled customers that you can actually win them back. They're easier to win back than customers, as long as they weren't like completely pissed off when they left. They're often easier to win back than customers who've never tried your software before. So whether it's through feature releases or just checking in with them, seeing, you know, maybe where they went, because then they canceled out of your software either because they don't need that kind of software anymore or they found a different solution. And so you want to know that information, know how you can serve them. So there's kind of those three main pieces of the life cycle is onboarding, retention, and then cancellation post-account kind of emails.
Well, I guess today we're going to focus on onboarding. Sure. And I think converting people into paying users is one important part of that. Definitely monetarily the most important part, but you also want to the users to get value out of your app, which is probably continuing after they pay, right?
Yeah. So, yes, at the root level, the job of onboarding emails is to convert customers. And that's where a lot of people get onboarding wrong is they think, okay, the job of these emails is to convert customers. And I'm going to do that by just like, constantly sending them. Yeah, bombarding them with like, don't forget to activate your account. And people send coupon codes and trial extensions or they don't send any emails at all, which is like a whole other thing. But, you know, if the only messaging they're getting is pay us money, then they aren't getting any value out of you or out of your brand. And unless you're in some super specific niche that has no competitors at all, which I can't actually think of one. I don't know if you can, Jane, but I can't think of a niche that there are no competitors. I know for a long time FreshBooks had said that they had no competitors. And
it's
then all
not
of a sudden
great niche. No, it's not a great niche.
Yeah. Right. Right. So, if you have competitors in your niche, you have to stand out and you have to create a connection between you and this trial customer. A trial customer is doing more than wondering if they should give you money. They're wondering if you're a good fit, if they can trust your team, if they feel connected to the people behind the product, if they understand the UI inside of the product. If they feel a true need for the product after all, because maybe they signed up because somebody said, oh, you need to use this product, but they don't actually need it. So there's so much more that they're wondering besides, should I give them my money or not? And you want to touch on all of those points throughout the onboarding journey.
I think the biggest concern these days, if you're really thinking about your user, compassionately, you know, sharing their problems. And the biggest problems they have is that their inbox is so full that you don't want to be really sending them daily emails during all their 14 days of trial. And then the question arises, then how much is enough and how much is not enough and where shall we stop and what shall we do to find that balance between engagement and obsessiveness?
Yeah, it depends. The worst response that anyone can give, right? No, there's no magic formula, and that's where the customer research comes into play. Mm-hmm. Because when you know who your customers are and what they want from your product, you know how often to email them, or you have a better idea of it. And then that's where testing comes in too. Emails, especially lifecycle emails, but emails in general, should never be set it and forget it, right? So you don't set up an onboarding campaign and then put it into play and walk away and never look at it again. You want to put it into place and then see what happens. Get some data, get some of those actual numbers back. See what your open rates and click-through rates look like. Test out different subject lines, A/B test subject lines and see which performs better. And then move things around. Maybe if you have like a 2-day span between emails, see what happens when you put a 1-day span between them or 3 days. And do those tests knowing that some of them are going to fail miserably. And trust that you're doing it as a temporary test to find out what works best in the long run. Because ultimately, you end up with an onboarding sequence or, again, a retention or a cancellation or whatever it's, campaign we're talking about here. But on like onboarding specifically, you'll end up, when you do all that testing, you'll end up with an onboarding sequence that that is useful for, you know, 6 months or so before you need to really look at it again. And you can put it into place and know that it's performing well across the board, that the subject lines are great, that you've tested every single piece of it, and that you know that it really does work. So I would say there's no magic formula other than the fact that sending one email at the beginning of the trial and one email at the end of the trial is not enough.
I would love some examples. You have amazing onboarding teardowns, so maybe you could supply us with some most successful examples when it's not too much and not too little and their industry and their product.
Yeah. So there's one teardown that I did recently on a product called MixMax. And MixMax does a really wonderful job with their onboarding teardowns. And I think we can maybe link to that particular teardown.
I just read it 10 minutes ago.
Oh, good. It's a good one. And I'm not saying that from the standpoint of like I wrote an amazing teardown. I'm saying that they did a really good job with their email onboarding. And there were very few things for me to kind of pick apart there. They did a really great job. They educate, they connect. They give examples. They help you see the value in the product. And at the end of the free trial, you want nothing more than to continue using it. What I love about MixMax is that it is a product, every product is going to be a little bit different as far as use cases. But in MixMax's case, it's so MixMax connects to your email and helps you manage your email and your customer flow a little bit better. So it helps you send reminders and you can send emails at later dates and times, and you can check in on if anyone's read your email that you sent, all those good things. And so it's something you use every single day in running a business and sending emails out in life. Not through your email marketing software, but like through your personal inbox. So MixMax wants you to see how you can use it every day and all the different features that they offer. And the great thing is that they don't bombard you with, these are all the features we have. They start with, here are the core features that you need to know about to really fall in love with MixMax. And then once they get you through that, then they say, and here's some other ones that you might be interested in too. So it's really about taking those like three core features that really help people adopt the product into their everyday life, making sure that they understand what those features are and that they are ingrained in them by the time the trial ends, so that they feel super connected to the product and to why they're getting value out of it through just those, like pick three. Your product might have 27 different features, but pick three of them that you want to make sure your new trial users know about and find value in.
Fantastic. To put in plain English what MixMax is actually doing, I mean, in dry numbers, over the course of 2 weeks, they're sending one welcome email with a great CTA to their webinar. Then they have seven tips, like little tips email, which have great illustrations in line showing around those features. And then they have the activation emails, right? That's what they do. So yeah. Essentially sending out tips to demonstrate how to use a product is a good strategy. And seven tips is not too much, right?
It's really not. MixMax, I believe, has a 30 day. Is it 30 or 14? I don't remember. Mm-hmm. It says in the teardown that I did. But, you know, seven really is not too much. They cover the basics of the product. And the other thing that I really love that MixMax does is they do a soft sell in almost every single email. So if you're ready to convert, you know, they tell you in that email, oh yeah, and if you want to use this feature, here's where you would upgrade your account. You know, free accounts are only able to do X, paid accounts can do Y. And so it's a little bit of a soft sell that happens in every single email before they send out those more hard conversion-based emails.
So those should be limited, right? One is the welcome email. Then usually there is one preceding the trial ending date. Then there is probably another one on the trial ending date. And then if they didn't convert, what do you do next?
Yeah, so if they don't convert, there's a couple of options, and it kind of depends on what you want to do with it. But what I think works really well is, one, offer a trial extension. And I usually encourage my clients to ask for some skin in the game with that, right? So they either need to have activated a certain feature in the account or done something with their account in order to extend their trial. So if they've done absolutely nothing, in the case of like ConvertKit, for example, as an email marketing software, if you've done nothing for the last 30 days, we're not going to offer you a free extension of your trial. But if you've uploaded a list of all your email subscribers and maybe created an opt-in form, great. You're showing a little bit of friction with the product. You're showing some skin in the game. We'll give you an extra 7 days of your trial to finish your onboarding. So I always encourage that after a free trial has lapsed, some kind of skin in the game, extra days on the trial, whether it's 7 or 14, whatever you want to offer. And then a discount is one that people like to offer too, is, you know, take X percent off of your first month. That's one that you don't want to discount too often or offer those too often to your customers, because a lot of times you don't know if a discount is what's holding people back. So you always want to, again, that's where you go back to that customer data and research to know, is a discount, is price a compelling thing for your potential customers? And if so, then discount might be an option for you. But if price really isn't a problem, then don't offer a discount, you know? And then another email that could happen after the free trial is just a reminder email. This is one that I did with a customer recently. With one of my clients, we were working on onboarding emails, and after the trial lapsed, I think it's like 2 weeks after the trial has lapsed, we send them an email and remind them that they can re-access their account anytime. Again, this depends on how you've set up the back end of your product. But in their case, they leave the account where it was. So the subdomain is still available to that person if they want to pick up where they left off. They can come back anytime. And sometimes it's just that little nudge. Hey, all you need to do is let us know and we'll reactivate your account. You know, you still have access to it. All you need to do is pay for the account to get it up and running. So those touch points are all based on the customer research that you do at the very beginning.
Another question. I know it's mostly not about emails, but about founders' take on things. But do you have a personal preference whether to ask for a card upfront for a trial or not?
Yeah.
And in case you do, how do you handle that, you know, first billing cycle, which can come as unpleasant with those people?
Right. So I think that you should ask for a card upfront. I understand the like no credit card required free trial, but I think that it doesn't. You get more account signups, sure. You get more free trial signups because there's absolutely no friction involved. But you get more quality signups when you ask for the credit card upfront. People are a little more invested. They understand, like, okay, I'm going to be charged for this. I better care about it. At least that's, you know, been my experience. And as I've done these customer interviews, what customers have told me, they care more when about actually using a product when they are putting a credit card down. Something that everyone can know too is that almost every customer I talk to notes in their calendar the day before their trial is going to expire.
Me too. Me too.
Yeah, I do the same thing, and I was thrilled to hear from dozens of other people that they do that. Well, trial reminder emails are important. Your trial customer probably already has that reminder set up for themselves. And I think that what's super important is reminding them their trial is coming to a close. They will be charged. You can do that. You will be charged messaging at any point. One of my recent teardowns was from Deep Dive. They do that messaging right up front. So they actually don't offer a free trial. They let you know you've been charged today. Your next billing date will be X date. So they say that right up front, what the billing date is. So I think, you know, tell them that you're going to be charging them again. I know founders, every time I say this to my clients, they say, I don't want to remind them that we're going to take their money. But I think it's the human thing to do, to say, hey, just a reminder, you know, your free trial ends in 3 days. We have your credit card on file and we will be charging you. If you want to update your credit card or make any changes to your account, here's a link to your account page. You can do that. And make sure your credit card is valid and all those things. Because sometimes people do put fake credit cards into free trials. But I think it's really important to message around the charges. It's, like I said, it's the most human thing you can do. Besides, otherwise you end up processing a ton of cancellations, and refunds because people are getting charged and seeing it on their bank statements and going, oh, I don't want that software anymore. And they didn't even tell me they were going to charge me. I forgot from 30 days ago or 14 days ago, whatever it was. And, now I'm mad. So you have a much better chance of having a happy customer if you just let them know when you're going to charge them.
Absolutely. And one more article I'd love to link to in the show notes is by our friends at Nusi. They had a great article describing why they're taking their cards up front, and that includes all of your arguments above. They're just striving to have more quality business.
Yeah, I mean, it's the same thing about like on general email marketing strategy. Single opt-in versus double opt-in. A double opt-in is going to have less signups in the long run because people do have to do a second step of confirming their email address. But you have more quality opt-ins. So, it just depends on if you are driving for vanity metrics, then go ahead, have a free trial with no credit card required. But if you're driving for a quality business that lasts over the long run, then I would say put a credit card on it.
Absolutely. What about freemium models? When you have the majority of your new users in the free plan and they don't have any deadline for converting. And I had that model with my previous SaaS, Tiny Reminder, and I had those tips in place, but I had a name for it, like a code name. And that was not a good code name. It was like beating a dead horse, essentially.
Yeah.
Because obviously, you're trying to grasp that, to catch that attention. But if people didn't convert in the first place, probably that's very unlikely to happen. But you still don't want to lose hope. How do you handle that?
Yeah, I think when people build, I mean, it's kind of like going back to the build stage. So if you're fortunate to be listening to this podcast and you're still in the like early idea phase of your business, then you can take with you the idea of building in as much friction as possible for your freemium model. So I think too many softwares give away everything in a freemium, and there's no incentive to upgrade. And I actually just went through this with a client where he decided to pull out a feature from his freemium model and only offer it to paid accounts. And it's a pretty major feature that a lot of the freemium users are using. And he's giving, what we did is we worked on emails that would give notice about this account change, he's changing his entire pricing structure, pulling that feature out from freemium and putting it onto paid plans. And all of that is going to transform the way that freemium works for him. He now has the ability to add in messaging for freemium on an ongoing basis, that if this is a feature that you want, you need to upgrade. So I think the problem comes in when you give away everything. I mean, it's the old, why buy the cow when you can have the milk for free? That old saying of, if you have all the features you need in a freemium model, why would you possibly upgrade to a paid account? And so making sure that from the beginning, your freemium is built in with a little bit of tension in it.
Mm-hmm. We had an episode with Bridget Harris of You Can Book Me. And we had exact same conversation, even though it may sound harsh in the philosophy standpoint, but you still want to make a living in order to help those who are in the free plan, right?
Absolutely. And if there's a feature that you know is going to be incredibly valuable, then you shouldn't be giving it away for free. And if it's kind of like the main impetus for people to come to you, I think Buffer does this really well with their free account where you can schedule up to 10 days worth of posts. But if you want to schedule beyond 10 days, which these days most people do want to schedule beyond 10 days, if you want to schedule beyond 10 days, you need their paid account in order to do that. And that's like the whole reason people will sign up for Buffer is to be able to schedule posts. So of course you want the paid account. And that's just one example of a really great reason to convert from freemium to paid.
Absolutely. I think our time is running out a little bit, but I have a bunch of smaller questions where I would love to have your best take on.
And okay, let's do it real fast. I'll try to be brief. I tend to be a little long-winded.
Yeah. No, you've been wonderful, but I just think I just have too many questions here. So these are your amazing link bait questions that you use for your own marketing. So what subject lines convert best?
ones that people aren't used to seeing all the time. I saw an article of a whole bunch of welcome emails from SAS, and they all were welcome to X, welcome to tiny reminder, welcome to.
All right.
Yeah.
So guilty as charged.
Yeah, everything. So write a unique subject line for Pete's sake.
Capitalization. I noticed you lately switched to no capitalization in your own emails, if I noticed correctly. Why?
Yeah, so either no caps or like just cap the first letter. So regular sentence capitalization as opposed to title caps, like a headline. I write the emails in my newsletter, and I encourage people to do the same in the way that I would write to a friend. So if I'm writing to you, Jane, I'm not going to title case the subject line. Like, hey, see you on Skype in 30 minutes. I'm not going to title anything in that. That's just going to be in my subject line, right? So so I write emails like I'm writing to a friend, and I think that's the best way to create connection between a brand and the person.
Emoji in title lines, emoji in emails.
Yeah. So emoji can be tricky. It definitely stands out in the subject line. Again, would you do that if you were writing to a friend? Would you take the time to add an emoji to a subject line? But you might add it inside of the body of the email. Sometimes emojis render improperly. So there's plenty of times where I've opened my inbox and there's like a little square where I know that means there's an emoji there and it's just not rendering properly. And I use Gmail, so one of the most popular inboxes out there. They don't always render properly. You want to make sure that you're conveying your message without the emoji. So always think, like, I need to know that this message is coming across, even if this emoji doesn't show up.
Subject lines like tip 7 out of 8 and stuff like that. Is it great? Does it give context or is it impersonal?
I think they give context if it's not, obviously, like tip 7 out of 8 isn't going to be the first email, but so like tip 1 of 7, for example, should never be your first email to a customer. You want to have an email that comes before that, that introduces them to the fact that, hey, I'm going to send you 7 tips over the next 7 days or over the next 14 days, whatever it is, and introduce them to the concept of what you're going to be sending in that way. And then, then it provides context, but otherwise it's just confusing.
You have your own writing style is very, very informal to me, at least.
Yes.
Like, it's probably too informal for me as a person. And if I run a business, that would be like overly informal. But that must mean something. Does that mean that all businesses should strive for informality in their style, or what is your best advice on that?
Not informality necessarily, comfortability. So you want the reader to feel comfortable with you as a brand. You want them to feel like they know who they're talking to. I like to think of this as thinking about your family. You do at least in most families, unless you're like a Gilmore Girl, you don't talk to your mom the same way you talk to your friends. Mm-hmm. Right. So, and your, and same, like your grandparents, you're going to speak to them differently than you would speak to your sister. And so there is a level of comfort with the way that you speak, to your customers that they get used to. If I wrote the way I write for like, I can't even think of one, but like a super buttoned up brand, Nationwide Insurance or something. If mm-hmm. if I wrote for them in my voice, it would feel, there would be a disconnect. But Nationwide can still write in a way that creates a connection, that makes it feel personal, and isn't entirely stuffy, legalese, hard to read conversations. It's, you know, it still is a conversation. It's not just straight up communication. So I think it's just a matter of like finding your brand's voice and communicating that way consistently.
Publishing content inline of your emails or sending them to an external, you know, knowledge base article.
Again, you have to test and you have to have that customer research to know. For instance, I talked to one business owner and she found, she creates weekly emails of things to do in New York City. So it's like a little bit of a news and things to do kind of compilation. And she found out through doing customer interviews that the majority of her customers were reading their emails on the subway, which means they cannot click through to anything. They won't read it if they have to wait for something to load. So she puts all the content right in the email. So you want to think about context. Are they reading it on the go? Are they sitting in front of their computer when they read it? Is it something like, and that this would probably actually be my one criticism for MixMax is they do a lot of, GIFs in the email, which like fine, it renders just fine, but maybe they're a little bit hard to read in an email, especially if I'm scrolling through an email on my phone. So clicking through to something where I can see it in more detail, if it's super long, maybe you want to try to click through to it. But again, test that with your audience. See what people like and what they respond to and where you get the most clicks.
A single call to action per email?
Yes. Single... Yeah, at the very most, double. I had somebody ask me when I said this, like, limit your number of call to action. They said, but there's an unsubscribe in every email, so there's already a call to action.
No.
Like, okay, besides unsubscribe, because we don't really want people to do that, right? So besides the unsubscribe, yes, one, maximum two calls to action, and that really depends on the overall messaging of the email.
If you have two links which repeat the same call to action, do you think it's better to keep those two or focus on one?
I like two sometimes. I'm a big fan of using the PS or like a TLDR if you have a longer email, and putting that same call to action there at the bottom of the email. Somebody just kind of scrolls to the bottom, is trying to get the gist. Here's the information, and here's the link for you. But you can also put it in the body of the email if you're having more of a conversation with the reader.
Mm-hmm. When you're done with promoting your top features, what do you do next? Do you just send product updates once in a blue moon, or what do you do?
Definitely continue to communicate with your customers. So even if you aren't creating like fresh blog content for them to link to, this is something that people run into a lot. It's like, well, I don't have a new blog post every week or anything that I can link to. You want to stay in communication with your customers every 2 weeks, kind of at minimum. I wouldn't really do more or less than that. So whether that's a feature update, and there's lots of options of ways to communicate with them. You can remind them about features that have recently launched. You can ask for feedback on newer features or on features that are coming. You can ask customers to become beta testers for you. You can link to blog posts on other people's sites. A lot of times founders are making the rounds to different podcasts to get the word out about their business. Link to a podcast that you've been on. Link to somewhere where you've guest posted. There's always things that you can share with your customers, because you have to remember that people on your email list, and this is like a segmenting thing, which is probably a whole other episode, Jane.
Right.
But you know, you want to remember that people on your email list are all walks of life. Not all of them are necessarily customers. And you also want to give them reasons to share that information with other people who are not yet customers of yours.
Awesome. And your three big mistakes, don'ts for email onboarding.
Don't forget to email people.
Right.
Definitely send more than two onboarding emails. So the biggest don't is don't just email them at the beginning of their trial and at the end of their trial. Don't be impersonal about it. So really work to drive that connection. Don't forget that you have competitors who are driving personal connections every single day, and you want to do the same. And then the final is, don't treat your brand new trial customers like they're just a wallet, right? So when I worked with online business owners, I always said, remember that they're people and not PayPal accounts. And so while your customers might not be paying with a PayPal account, that's really important to remember, is that there's a human being on the other side of the computer screen, and they are so much more than a $9 a month, a $27 a month, a $49 a month fee. They can build or crash your business as an individual, and you want to keep that in mind every time you talk to them.
That is amazing advice. We need to wrap up, but it was amazing. Thank you so much, Val, for your insight today.
Thanks for having me, Jane. I could talk to you about this anytime.
Where can people find you and your amazing work online?
Oh, yeah. ValGeisler.com is my website, and it's GEISLER. And then you can also tweet me. I'm mostly on Twitter these days, @LoveValGeisler. You can find me there. And come say hi. Say hi and let me know that you listen to the podcast. I would love to hear from you and chat on Twitter more.
You have a book coming up or available these days, which is called The Dinner Party Strategy, which is super enticing for me. Could you tell me what the dinner party strategy is about?
Dinner party strategy is the process that I go through with my customers, my clients. So it's all about collecting that data and customer research, and that's like the main dish of the dinner party. And then everything served around it, the emails, the strategy itself, it's all based on that main dish. So I like to think of the way we email our customers, that life cycle is really, it's a lot like throwing a dinner party in your home, and you want to have the same experience for your customers, that they feel like you've really brought them in and welcomed them and given them some value and something that they can take away, and that they want to go and tell people about, when they go to work the next day, they talk about, oh, I had this awesome, went to this awesome dinner party last night. And that's the experience you want to give your customers when you're onboarding them into your product. So that's the process I take my my clients through. And I share more about that in the book. And as we're recording this, I'm finishing up wrapping some revisions on that ebook, and it'll be available. We'll put a link to it in the show notes for you.
It's free for download, right?
Yeah. It's a free download, so you can grab that on my website. And I'm excited to walk people through the process, because you can download it and apply it to your business today.
Amazing. Thank you, Val, for sharing. And have a great day.
Thank you. You too, Jane.
If you enjoyed listening to this episode, please leave a review on iTunes. It will help other people discover this podcast.